Hi guys, welcome to Level Up, the show around game development. Today I'm interviewing Ken Lobb, Tech Director in Microsoft Studios. He's working on games within the ID at Xbox program. As you may know, ID at Xbox is a program that enables qualified game developers to publish their games to Xbox One and to have enormous support and help from Microsoft Studios. Today I'm very happy I have with me Ken Lobb. Hi Ken, welcome to Level Up. Who's tech director of in Microsoft Studios, not of all Microsoft Studios,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Can we start talking about your career? I know you have very long and big career at Microsoft, and especially on games. So let's start from the beginning. What is the degree that you have, and some of the games you worked on, maybe?
Sure. So this is a long time ago. So I went to school at DeVry, actually. I got the BSW at DeVry in 82. I actually started working first not in games. I worked at AMD. Mm-hmm. And so I was an engineer for about 6 years and then got into the game industry in late 1988. I've been making games ever since. My first company was Taxan USA, making just NES licensees. Mm-hmm. I made five or six games for the Nintendo Entertainment System. I moved from there to Namco in 1991. Mm-hmm. Most people know Namco as Pac-Man or Tekken.
Oh, nice.
So I was there for about 3 years. And then in 1993, I moved to Nintendo. So I worked at Nintendo for just over 9 years. Worked on many games there, probably the most memorable being GoldenEye, Killer Instinct, Perfect Dark. Mm-hmm. Came to Microsoft just after the original Xbox shipped in 2002. Mm-hmm. I've been here happily making games ever since. As you mentioned, all told, I think I've worked on, I have credits in something around 200 games.
Yeah,
right now, people, I manage a group of designers that work on all the games that we publish inside of Microsoft Studios, and we have about 12 going on right now at the same time.
Can you explain to the people watching us, what do you mean by Microsoft published games? So it's not games that are produced by Microsoft, or it's not Microsoft games, but it's published by Microsoft. Can you explain what is
Sure. Loosely speaking, you could say that there's three types of games in the game industry. If you play on any device, if you're playing on a phone, if you're playing on a PC, if you're playing on a console, games can be categorized as sort of internal development. So like Halo.
Yeah.
So we owned Bungie. They spun out. We formed a group internally called 343. There's a couple hundred people work there, and their job is they make Halo. They're all Microsoft employees. Independent developers are kind of the third bucket. Mm-hmm. So people that can make games that they just themselves put up on Steam or put into the ID at Xbox program or et cetera, go on to different platforms publishing by themselves. The third type is game publishing. Basically, you could think of as we go out and find developers who have great game ideas. We help fund them. We also attach to that game team a full, what we call leads team, someone who's exceptionally good at production development, so someone who's highly technical. Art, again, typically a technical artist.
Yeah.
Audio, help them either with contracts, find outsource music, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Go full record orchestras. Mm. Someone on the user research side, somebody in marketing, and then under my team, mm-hmm. a designer. Mm-hmm. The design in publishing is an interesting job because you don't often do the design from scratch. Yeah. In fact, that's rare case. Usually it's our partner who's designing the game. What a publishing designer does is help them make their game better. There's a lot of detail around that.
Yeah, can you explain a little bit, like an example of a game that is already out there and maybe some changes that happened that you worked on?
So maybe a best example would be something like Killer Instinct.
Okay.
So, and that's an extra interesting one because it covers two of these three categories. Originally, when I was at Nintendo, I helped design Killer Instinct. And we did it at Rare, who was this quasi-first, second party. So they were half-owned by Nintendo. Mm-hmm. So they were independent, but we really owned them. I helped with the basic design of the game. And when it first started, it actually was nothing like what we finished. I came up with the idea for the combo system, combo breakers, ultra combo, just too many details to go over in less than hours.
Okay.
All right. And that happens not as a, hey, here's what you should do, here's a spec, go do it.
Mm-hmm.
The way all games are developed, really internally, externally, is a bunch of people with a great idea start with something, and then they iterate constantly, you know, and iterate if you're a great team until the last possible second. Your goal is to make the game as good as it possibly can be and ship as close to on time.
Yeah, what is on time?
We can come back to that.
Okay.
So I believe what a great designer does is they use their intuition, data from other games in the genre, data from we love user research. So we do a lot of let's bring some people in who've never seen this game, let them play, ask them some questions, mm-hmm. literally watch their faces and hands to see, you know, because it's one thing to have somebody play a game and then fill out a form. Mm. It's another thing to watch them play. We also do a lot of data collection, so especially on games in development, we will what's called instrument them. We know every button press, we know every time someone dies, we know where they crashed their car, we know, and we can look at that data to help, you know, make the game more fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, really the job of the designer, the people on my team,
yeah.
is to make sure the games we're building are as fun as they possibly can be.
How do you measure fun?
You put your finger in the, you play, right?
You play.
And again, we have a formal version. When a game is in the right state, we'll put it into user research and we have standardized forms. Mm. We have a fun score.
Yeah.
You know, and then we have a bar that we consider, is it over that bar? Okay, it's reached a high enough fun score.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is what I trust is, again, my taste. And what I trust and hire for is people that can play a game and tell me if they think it's fun.
Mm.
And fun can't just be, hey, it's super fun, but really ugly, buggy, and it's never going to sell. Right? These things all need to pile up into something that can have some level of success.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But all that in my mind, first and foremost, some of this comes from, I believe, just my personal taste in games, but some of it was beaten into me nicely when I worked at Nintendo.
Yeah.
I got to work a lot with Mr. Miyamoto. You know, famous guy, made Zelda, Mario, et cetera.
Yeah.
And he is always very fixated on the core mechanics. Are they rewarding? Are they fun? And so a lot of times fun is a moment to moment, right? And I believe as the game industry has matured and games get more complicated, bigger, they have many more layered systems, you start to measure fun on things other than moment to moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I will always come back to, first and foremost, it needs to be fun to move my character from A to B.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then we can layer more fun on top of that with, again, layered systems, leveling up in an RPG, or a lot of times a game is fun because the story is good,
yeah.
or because of a world simulation, or because a character that I find that I care for and I want to save them, help them, mm-hmm. kill them if it's a bad guy. Because sometimes it's, it are the bad characters in a game that make it fun. You know, mm-hmm. vengeance is a fun emotion.
Mm-mm.
And also as the industry has matured, I think designers in general have gotten, shall we say, more sophisticated around, you know, fun as a tight mechanic is one thing, but fun as an emotional roller coaster ride and starting to think about difficulty balance as a thing that can help something fun. Another thing that I think a lot of people don't realize about games, and this is a generalistic statement, but it's true. If a game is really, really easy, it's not fun. And if it's really, really, really hard, it's not fun.
Yeah.
Well, you can look at that scientifically, and what you realize is that this emotional roller coaster of challenge is part of what makes something rewarding. If there's no challenge, there's very little reward.
Yeah.
And again, sometimes that's mechanically. Am I dexterous enough to do these crazy moves, and therefore I can succeed? Other times, it's just strategic choice. You know, not all games are about twitch, right? I might be making choices in the way I set up an army and then just send that army out and watch and make little adjustments. But tactically, I was smart. Well, then when I succeed, endorphins fire, I had fun.
Mm-mm.
All right, so again, going after that, both just from a very base level, you know, up through what are some emotional drivers for different types of users. And then right to the top is the overall experience polished. Do I keep a user engaged? Mm. Can I keep them engaged even after they finish the game? Yeah. These are the type of things that we try and go after as we help teams.
Seems fun and it seems very complicated.
That's not everybody has to know how sausage is made. That's the the term we like to, you know, think about. Going back to your earlier question about when is a game done?
Yeah.
It's one of the things that I like working, you know, like about working at Microsoft Studios. When we sign a game, internally or externally, when we decide to make a game, you have a date, right? It's March 2nd. We're going to finish this game on October 30th, 2017.
Wow.
Isn't that awesome? That's impossible, right? It's impossible to know a schedule that might have, literally you have millions of assets in some of the games we work on now. You know, a game's raw database can be, you know, approaching a petabyte, you know, and then you ram all that down into your 50 gigabyte disk. Mm. Knowing exactly when you're gonna be finished is, it's sorcery, right? So what great game developers do is they will gauge how much they can get done. And then what Microsoft Studios, I think one of the things that we're good at is we've got a date that we're targeting, but we're not mandating, right? And a simplification of the process that we use is when we sign in the contract, it says that date. Internally in the books, it's that year, right? And as we move through development, part of the goal of going from, we call them gates, you know, as we move through these different gates of development, what you're really doing is you're honing in to the actual launch date. And you're still targeting, in the case I told you, sometime in October 2017. But you might be 18 months out and go, no, we're actually going to be spring 2018. And that's not failure, right? Yeah. Knowing at the right time in development how much longer it's going to take, how many more assets you have to build,
and why,
is a big part of what makes good game development. You add that with... it's funny because I used to build games when I was first starting. Our spec was 2 pages long, and we just start to build the game, and then we'd add and add and add and add, and then we'd finish, and then we'd ship. All that was 8 months with 3 to 15 people. Right, things happened very quickly in the '80s and early
'90s. Now it takes.
Now some games are over 1,000 people, and you go through different stages of development where you're adding and adding and adding people. So that you can kind of turn on the fire hose of assets, and you have to be ready. So,
and how long does it take to build these games? 3 years, I
think. 2 years.
2 years.
If you're making a sequel, or if you're making a game in a known kind of, I know what I'm building and I know the story I'm telling. You're still going to iterate heavily, but 2.5 years is pretty standard. But if you're starting a game from scratch in a crazy new genre on new hardware, like when we were hitting Xbox One launch, 3 years or more is not unusual. And 1 year or less is very, very
fast game.
it almost never happens outside of the indie space, just because people's expectations of what they get out of a game have changed so much over time. To finish the part about iteration, my philosophy and I think we've integrated it well across studios for most of the projects we work on, is there's kind of three elements that you have access to when you're building a game. You have the spec. That was that thing we signed in the contract. Sometimes they're very detailed, maybe hundreds of pages long. Then you've got the build, so the latest version of the game. And then you have the next milestone or next few milestones. The most important thing in my mind, by miles, is the build. I'm not going to judge a game based on what it might be, or even on what it could be based on the next few weeks' work. I'm going to judge it based off what it is. I can play it, I can touch it, I can comment on it. And then importantly, I can make sure, you know, me and the people that, you know, work for me, and really all the people that work in publishing, can think hard about, okay, these are the things that are right in the current build. These are the things that are great in the current build. These are the things that are okay. These are the things that are bad. Now let's look at the short-term next schedule and make sure that we're spending the most time on the thing that's the most fun. And these things that are kind of okay or broken, we want to either give them a quick chance to be good or Get rid of them. Mm-hmm. I don't care if they were in the original spec. I don't care if they were in the first game in the series and we're working mm-hmm. in a sequel. Mm-hmm. I care about what's in the build and is it fun. And if you use that as your kind of guiding light, it does a couple things. First of all, it naturally causes you to iterate.
Yeah.
That you always know exactly what you're doing in 2 weeks. But even that changes. And what definitely changes is what you're doing a month or 2 months out. Mm. And it changes based on, you know, again, I played this. This is what I see. Here's what's great. Mm-hmm. Go attack that. That thing that's super fun. Add. We only have 25,000 man months. Mm. You know, if you're going to make a big game, you've got something in that kind of crazy range of manpower.
Yeah.
Focus it on the things that are going to make your game better and get the noise out of the way. You know, the things that aren't working. Mm. It's okay to iterate on something that might work. Don't do it with a lot of your team. Get the big part of the team working on the stuff that you know is going to be great.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really, really great advices about iteration. I really like them. Now, if we go back to the 200 games that you worked on, which are the games that you enjoyed the most?
Well,
Playing, because so I'm going to ask you about playing later.
Yeah, so there's obvious. I could say GoldenEye, because it's the one most people know, or Killer Instinct, because we're making it again now. And those were pretty close to the top. But if I was going to think about a top five or six, mm-hmm. there's a few games that, you know, may surprise people. Mm-hmm. One was Tetrisphere. So I was, quick list, why?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
it was the first $1 million game that we signed at Nintendo, which was a pretty big plateau. We were working on games that cost more, but this was the first, let's go to an external developer that we're not positive about, and you want to pay them what? Pay them $1 million, ooh. You know, and the game was super fun. It was ridiculously agile. We changed it completely from when we started to when we finished. And when we got about 2/3 of the way through, I was super happy with the multiplayer mode. Mm-hmm. I was pretty happy with the one-player mode. And I got the opportunity to contract Alexey Pajitnov, the original designer of Tetris, mm-hmm. to come help. So I got to be friends with Alexey, which was pretty cool. He actually ended up working here. Mm-hmm. When I first started, Alexey was working here. He's off doing other fun things now. But it was just cool to work with Alexey. So I put that near the top. Some other ones I liked working on just last year, like we talked about earlier, I got to work on Sunset Overdrive.
Yeah.
And, you know, Insomniac is a Sony, primarily they had done Sony work in the past. And I've always respected their work. Ratchet & Clank is one of my favorite series of all time, especially in that kind of Mario-like game. I think it's one of the best games ever made that didn't come from Mr. Miyamoto and his team mm-hmm. in that kind of genre. And so to be able to work with them was super fun. It was great to see that game change from when we first started until we shipped. Really proud with what the team did. I would definitely put that in the list of things that the most. Maybe the other one's a little obscure, you know, but it's the truth, right?
Yeah.
So, of course, my first game.
Oh, yeah.
When I first started working, I had a pretty big impact on a game that was already in development called Burai Fighter, and just made some changes to the way it controlled scoring system, the way it unlocked cheats, stuff like that. But I built a relationship with that developer. When I finished that game, my boss let me design my own game, and he let me pick, you know, well, where would you like to develop this? You could find an American, you know, maybe American developer. You don't have to come to Japan so much. I like going to Japan.
Yeah.
But it was like, no, I actually, these people, we just did a great job working on this game. I like them. I like the designer who's on site. Their tech is good. Let's just work with them. And so I was able to make my first game, Logi Man. It did okay. Sold about 500,000 units. I was very happy with the way it succeeded. Nothing like GoldenEye or some of my bigger successful titles. But it was my entry to the industry that will always go down as, you know, and it's still fun. Surprisingly, when I one of the rules I used to use, and I'm pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I can play games. I like games. I own thousands. I play games every day. I'm old, so maybe I'm not quite as good as I was when I was in my 20s and 30s and 40s. I'm 54. But I can still beat a lot of people at a lot of games.
Maybe
right?
I can ask you the next question then. What is the games that you enjoy playing the most?
I like all games. I lost count. I have thousands. I mean, I literally have thousands of games. I have every platform pretty much ever made. There's a couple obscure, like, Japanese handhelds, like the WonderSwan. I don't have a WonderSwan. I'm sorry, handheld collectors of the world. I have every other handheld ever made. But I love fighting games. I love racing games. I love RPGs. I like open world games. I love horror games. You know, any game with a really good story. Mm. But I also like ridiculously simple casual games. I have like literally 2,000 games on my iPad. Mm-hmm. And I like phone games. I've got 80 games on my Windows phone. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just, I like to play games that are, I categorize this in a particular way and talk to my teams about it. One of the interesting things about console games, they used to be very time slice singular, I think of it as. In other words, most console games, you couldn't sit down and play a minute. You kind of had to play for 20 minutes or an hour, you know, before you would progress, get to the next save point or, beat the next level or fight the next boss, do that side quest, go do a daily in WoW. All these things are like 20 minutes or longer. And one of the things that I think mobile games added to the design methodology of games is to think about your game design in, is there something you can do in your game in 30 seconds or a minute? Because that's actually not bad, because it ends up being like a opening in the door. And what I found was, and I can play a lot. I'm married. I've been married for 33 years. My wife is very understanding of my game addiction. I mean, hobby. But sometimes if I've got a game I'm playing where in order to progress, I have to play 40 minutes or more, I don't turn that game on the way I used to. But if that same game has little things that I can do that only take a few minutes, I might turn it on and play for 3 hours, because I'll turn it on, I'll do a few of these things that only take a couple minutes, and it's like, well, it's fun, I'll go do that quest. Well, it took an hour. Well, so what? I'll go look at another couple little things, and oh, then I'll go to that dungeon. And then I end up playing 3-4 hours straight. But the thought that the only thing I can do takes 40 minutes ends up sometimes causing me to not turn the game on.
Oh, this is nice tip.
It's one of the things. What's funny is I find the exact opposite on mobile. I will only play mobile games if they are primarily things that take 1 to 3 minutes. And some of them I play for months. But I want to know that it's a phone.
I need
to be able to just, we're driving somewhere or, my wife is checking her email for a minute at dinner so I can play a level while she's looking at Facebook, If I have to turn the phone on and play for 20 minutes, I'm never going to play that game, even if it has a bunch of little parts in it. So finding that kind of time slice versus game genre versus platform type is an interesting matrix. And I think it's just those little short games caused me to spend a lot of time on devices that didn't exist, seven or eight years ago. Didn't really have an impact on how much I play, hardcore AAA $60, $100 games. But they just added to the palette of type of games I like to play. But they also added to, me at least having the conversation with all of our teams. Make sure your game has stuff to do that short duration. So if somebody wants to play for 5 minutes, I call it everything counts, that if somebody wants to play for 5 minutes, that 5 minutes should feel like it mattered. The simple description, I leveled up. I went in, I played for 5 minutes, I leveled up. Or I earned a little bit of gold, or, I played one versus game on Hearthstone. These things help me want to turn the game on again and again and again and again over time, whether it's console or PC or mobile or handheld.
Very nice tip. I really appreciate that you're sharing this tip with everyone right now. Okay, let's talk very interesting subject now, money.
Yep.
Do you have any tips to people that are building their game so they can earn a little bit of money? Because as we talked off, I remember we were talking about free games that no one even discover in the stores and no one even download. So how they should manage to make their game discoverable, and then how to manage to earn money.
Yep. So I'm going to take that answer a little bit tangent.
Yeah.
Just PR in general is hard. And it used to be a very closed group of people had access. They tended to be PR managers for all the different companies, had access to game magazine people. And if you wanted to be seen in the press, you kind of had to go through these. I know that person that knows the editor of Electronic Gaming Monthly, and therefore I should talk to that person. They'll talk to the editor. They'll come interview the team. PR. I think what's then along comes free to play, and first mobile games that were cheap. Hey, the only way I can play a game is $30 to $60 on a console. No, you actually have a game device in your pocket and you can play a game for a dollar. Mm. And so a lot of people were actually getting their PR by being a really cheap game in a mobile store would get them raised to the top of some chart, and that was their PR. Then free-to-play came, and suddenly a dollar was pushed down the list. And you'd look at it, hey, where can I get PR? I can go look at a, I can go look at the App Store, or I can go to the Microsoft, you know, phone store, Google Play, any of them, they're all the same. You know, they'll all have some kind of top grossing, top downloaded, top. That is them trying to attack this problem of top downloaded is not necessarily top grossing, because top downloaded, which for a while was the only metric they tracked, suddenly got populated by nothing but dollar and then nothing but free. And it didn't act as a good way for you to find a game that was great. So seeing this aggregated view helps. And developers should understand, though, that, and again, this is a very N equals one. I do a lot of research just because I play. And so one of the things that I've noticed in my own behavior, I don't go to app stores to buy games. I go to forums. So go to Reddit, or the, for mobile games, I go to something called Touch Arcade. And, you know, I want to see what people think. You know, a new game comes out, and if you're on mobile, 500 new games come out every week. I need some army of fans to go play and, no, here's the 20 games that came out last week that matter. How do I know they matter? Because they're the ones that are at the top of these forums, and more people are talking about them. That's kind of the new PR. You still need, if you're a big game, you still need television, you probably still need PR. But what you really need is people to like your game. And, you know, we live in a world where everybody has access to Twitter. Anybody can pretty much now on any platform, you can get to Twitch. So you can buy a new game and put it up on Twitch. You can go to places like NeoGAF or Reddit or, you know, Touch Arcade, other places where people like to talk about games and see people talking about the things that are becoming popular. So rather than thinking about, you know, just straight up, how do I make money? In other words, how do I get myself seen in an app store? A lot of developers, what they should be thinking about, smaller developers, how do they get seen in these social places where people talk about games? I think it's one of the reasons why PAX has become so popular. Penny Arcade Expo, if you're familiar with that, it's a show that started in Seattle. Penny Arcade was just a little webcomic, and they decided that they wanted to have this expo where people would come and play board games and collectible card games, and maybe video games. And now, it's about 12 or 13 years since the first one. They have in Australia, Texas, Boston is next week, or this weekend, and still the big one every year, PAX Prime, is in Seattle. And there are, you know, 60 or 80,000 people come, and if you can get your game seen there, now 80,000 people that are very passionate about games are more likely to go out onto their Facebook and Twitter ecosystems and talk about the game that they found, the game that they love. So it's, PR has become very, very, very grassroots. If you're making a game, oftentimes the best technique is to figure out who has a big following and then get them to like your game, get them at least try it. And PAX and shows like that are good places to do it. Game Developers Conference, also in San Francisco this week. You move up the scale, and we do the same thing. So we have Major Nelson. Right? Someone with nine, he might have a million followers now, you know, and so if Major Nelson says, hey, you should watch this video, then that's, it's getting to the point where that's as powerful as a multi-million dollar ad campaign. You know, so maybe you should spend time on making sure that, you know, people like Major Nelson that are independents out in the world are getting access to your game. So we're starting to give away codes, you know, right before a game launches. It used to be, hey, who are the 10 magazines around the world? We'll send them review copies, nobody else. Now we're starting to send out a few thousand, you know, review copies to all these just the people that are just in their bedrooms or in their living rooms, you know, in their own homes. And they've got 100 followers, 1,000 followers, 100 million followers like PewDiePie, you know, that listen to what these people have to say about what they like to do. And that's, it's, big opportunity. What's interesting is the opportunity to become those people is still happening. So it's every day there's like new people. Hey, I'm so-and-so on Twitch showing you my playthrough of the new game I just bought.
Yeah.
And 12 people are watching. And yet sometimes if that person is good or the right 12 people are watching, then 10 of them follow and that person comes back. And in the last year, I've started to notice, especially around Killer Instinct, because you know it's a game that I pay attention to. It's one of my old babies and it's the designer is under me. So it's in my responsibility. But I just love the game anyway, so I watch it a lot on Twitch. And I've seen some people on Twitch go from nothing to, you know, 100,000 followers.
Nice.
And, you know, so they are very powerful members of the video game industry as it exists today. I love it. Fans have a powerful voice.
Yeah.
Again, I think, what do they decide on? It's not whether or not they got schmoozed at some dinner or invited to some party. They're judging the game whether or not it's fun.
Yeah,
and then they want to talk about it because to them, talking about it is fun. That's great.
Yeah, it's really great because it's transparent. It gives the reality about the game, not only the press thing.
Yep.
But still, you said that marketing is important. So how is marketing important? How can these parties pay for marketing? Is it worth it to contact like Microsoft Studios and have a contract with them so
they
can help?
Absolutely. So one of the things we do is called ID at Xbox. Mm-hmm. And so small independent developers should be coming to ID at Xbox to pitch their game. Mm-hmm. And that's just to get on the platform. And again, that funnel is opening to the point where at some...
Do you have a max number?
Anybody. Right now we have hundreds, I think.
Okay.
When we started out, it was a smaller team. It was a new effort. It was tens. I think it's hundreds. It will get to the point where it's just like the App Store.
Yeah.
If you want to put your game up, go ahead. Mm. Right. But the other reason you contact them is because they also help do PR for you. You know, the games that are great that end up being on ID at Xbox, then you get Major Nelson and Chris Charla and his team talking about, hey, this game is coming and it's fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, they help push to get the game represented in the shell.
Yeah.
You know, so when you turn on your Xbox, you see iDarb. Mm, you know, kick-ass game that came out last month. Or we do deals to make their game free for, you know, games with gold. And again, I think as we move into the Windows 10 world, where we finally care more about gaming on PC again, we're going to do the same kind of thing, is find people that are building great games that come out on PC and help them, you know, help them get their game exposed in ways that they can be most successful.
Nice. I think you already gave so many advices to everyone around there. Can we talk a little bit about the future? So you worked on games for so many years. How do you see the future of the gaming industry?
So game industry has evolved a lot. And like many things in technology, I think we're on a exponential curve of evolution.
Yeah.
And the biggest change that's coming, that's been happening you could say it started in mobile.
Yeah.
It's this idea of games as a service. And to me, games as a service doesn't mean free to play with microtransaction. Games as a service means the game ships, you see the way people play the game and what they like, and then you add based on what they like, often for free. Sometimes you'll have PDLC, but even that is determined by what people actually like, rather than guessing, which is what we did last gen.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we're going to make this game, and then we're going to have two PDLCs. They come out 30 and 60 days after launch. And we think they'll like this and this. That's what we'll make. We live in a world now where we can know what they like, right? We can ask them what they like. We have stats, obviously, that come off of the way people play. And we can see and react and then change what we're building in the future. This is the way, you know, not to talk about KI again, but that's the way Killer Instinct was made. So we built the game and shipped it when it was only 60% done.
Yeah.
And so what that meant was, not only did we have to ship the last 40% after people started buying it, but we were able to see the way people played. It, for many genres, that would be just about, hey, people have fun with this, so make more.
Mm-mm.
When it comes to competitive games like Killer Instinct, we did as much work around, okay, we think it's perfectly balanced. We shipped the game with 6 characters the first time, and we played them tons. We had pros, like people that are professional fighting game players play. We have a balanced game, ship. But then all of a sudden, millions of people play it. And it's like, that move is a little too powerful.
Yeah.
This character you know, the way their special move is a little too weak, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And you just tweak and bounce and tweak and bounce until we get to the point where we think it's perfectly balanced.
Yeah.
Now we're in the middle of season two, but it's the same game, it just adds. Mm. And we are continuing to add features and balance and build new characters based on the type of the way that people are playing the game as it exists today.
Yeah.
And I think that's a peek at the way all games should be.
Yeah. But this is near future. How about far future? Not 5 years, because I see you're building games in 3 years, but 10 years from now, 20 years from now.
So my hope, again, if you think about what's happening with VR and what's happening with HoloLens, mm-hmm. you know, that virtual reality and mixed reality or augmented reality is going to be a big part of our lives. It's not just about gaming.
Yeah.
Right? It's like if I could just have a game happening in the room, or if I could, you know, telepresence, you know, play with a bunch of players, not just and I see their little avatar, but it's you, yeah. you know, and you and I are on some adventure in a forest,
yeah.
you know, but you're in your house, maybe in another country, and I'm, you know, here. Telepresence, I think, will have an impact on the way that people play games. Seeing further than that, I think we are, if you look at art today, there are some games that are, you know, very close to real.
Yeah.
Right? And if you go out 5 to 20 years, we're obviously going to, I think we're going to get to the point where
it is real.
We are well on the other side of the uncanny valley, if you're familiar with that statement, where something looks so real.
Mm.
What happens with uncanny valley is if you look at a certain rendered version of a human,
mm-hmm.
sometimes they look really bad. Even though the art might be kind of good, it's because the human ability to recognize, okay, you're a woman. And when you smile just the tiniest little bit, I know you're kind of happy. And if a character just sits there, it just seems spooky and unnatural,
yeah.
right? And as we get closer and closer to reality, this might be what people aren't expecting me to say. I think it enables us to go more fantasy.
Okay.
So in other words, once I can create a perfect human and a perfect room in a perfect world, maybe I can make something that's really psychedelic and bizarre and weird, because we will have proven that we can do perfect.
Yeah.
Now let's do a different version of perfect. Mm. You know, again, take Van Gogh. You know, Van Gogh was better than perfect. You know, the other interesting one, I learned this like 30 years ago, 25 years ago, but I was shocked when I saw it the first time. People think of Pablo Picasso, mm. and they think about strange-faced, weird square nose. Then I saw his earlier work, and he was a perfect painter. He could paint to perfection. But once he mastered that,
he
moved into impressionist.
Okay.
Right? And it was kind of like, yeah, photograph. I can do photograph. Now I want to do awesome. Mm. So I think one of the things that's going to happen, you know, as we go forward over time, as we exercise perfect reality, then
go
fantasy,
over.
You know, crazy yes. reality, crazy science fiction, it becomes more acceptable.
Do you want to live in that world, or is it a little bit scary?
I want to play games that yes. do everything. I want to play super real racing games. I want to play in VR. I want to have AR gaming surrounding me everywhere. I love to play games, you know.
I can see that.
I think another thing that's coming,
yeah?
and you're starting to see the hints of it now, is interactive storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's games from a company called Telltale, they started out with Sam and Max. These are kind of graphic adventures from a long time ago. They moved forward to Walking Dead was their first big success.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're in the middle of doing a Game of Thrones. And the game is more of a conversation system. You're a new family in the Game of Thrones world called the Forresters.
Mm-hmm.
You're this young prince. I don't want to give any spoilers.
Yeah.
But it's very much the Game of Thrones. In other words, all choices are bad. And your job is to make sure the bad choices aren't the really bad choices. But people are going to die. Bad things are going to happen. And it's all up to you.
Yeah.
And I love the Game of Thrones. I love watching it. I love reading it.
Mm.
Somehow playing this is, it's not better because, you know, the story might not be quite as good as,
yeah.
you know, the real Game of Thrones. But the fact that I can make choices, you know, has a big impact on the way I feel. Mm. I believe when you start thinking about AR and VR and what it might mean for linear media, you know, I can see a future where we're sitting here and the next Star Wars is right there, you know, and you feel like you're sitting in it. And maybe you can move your camera position. Mm. Just get up and move. I want to see the side. Oh, I'll just go over there and I'll sit and I'll watch from an angle. That could have an impact. And you could see this kind of more blurring of interactive and linear media types.
Yeah.
So I do think that we're in for a radical shift. I do hope that people still like to play on controllers and still like to play beautiful 2D games as much as I love playing them now. But I'm looking forward to some of the cool new things that tech will bring 2 years from now, 10 years from now. Hopefully I'm still playing games 30 years from now. 84 years old, I can still play games.
Definitely. I think if games will progress, I guess also medical and health will progress. So you're going to be fine.
Yep.
Thank you so much for this interview. I want to end with, if you want to tell anyone about new games that you're working on and you want to tell them, go there and play them and give them some marketing, marketing.
In the short term, I mean, it's serendipitous that we're shipping a couple things in the next 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So we have Scream Ride and then Ori and the Blind Forest. Scream Ride is this kind of crazy roller coaster game where it's broken up into four parts. You have a race mode where you're actually driving a roller coaster. It's kind of a crazy idea, but very addictive once you get used to what you're doing. Basically, you're earning turbo boosts by timed button press through these kind of blue glowy parts of tracks. That gives you turbo. And you're balancing because the cars can literally fly off the track. Second mode is kind of like Angry Birds. You've got these crazy rides where, and people kind of enjoy it. You hear them screaming and laughing as you throw this ball into giant buildings that all come toppling down with great physics. It's pretty cool. And then the third mode, which is my favorite, maybe because I'm engineer background, maybe because I like puzzle solving, it's called engineering mode. They'll give you a fixed space and you have to build a roller coaster inside of it that meets a certain set of criteria. And we have thousands of track parts and building pieces. You can build buildings of many, many different types, embed them. You can have your roller coaster going through buildings, etc. The fourth mode is actually the tool that we use to create all the stuff that we ship. So, and a full sharing system. So you can build new roller coasters to race on, or new destruction mode stuff, or new engineering challenges for people, and then share them up. So hopefully that'll give this game infinite life because people can continue to come back and play all the great free stuff that people have made and shared. Ori and the Blind Forest is an interesting developer story, so I'll try and go quick.
Yeah.
But Ori is actually created by 10 people who never met each other until E3 last year, even though they've been working on the game for just over 2 years, I think, at the time. Mm-hmm. So they were truly a distributed solution for development using Unity. It's a gorgeous 2D side-scroller Metroidvania, so kind of an adventure game where you earn new abilities that then those abilities unlock bigger and bigger parts of the game. But the entire game is hand-painted. It's just phenomenally beautiful. And the story in the game is so heartwarming. I don't want to spoil it at all,
but
it is worth playing this game even just for the story. The game mechanics are great. The art is phenomenally beautiful. The story is fantastic. I mean, so highly, highly recommend it. So I love Scream Ride. Ori is one of the best games I think that'll ship this year.
Nice.
So I would advise people, go play Scream Ride. It's a blast. Don't miss Ori. It's one of the best games I've ever played.
Nice, nice. Thank you so much, Ken.
It was my pleasure and very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Looking forward to watching more Level Ups.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me on.